Okie dokie. The training world is full of technical editing courses that don't teach the high-end creativity that viewers expect. Inside the Edit was created specifically to teach you every single creative skill you'll ever need to mesmerize your audience. And we are back. So, directors, what do they want? How do we deal with them? Our careers depend on them. They choose who they want to edit with. And if they weren't there, we'd have nothing to cut. We really do rely on them. So, what do they need from us? And how best do we understand the psychology of the edit suite? All of this and more on this week's show. Hello again, dear friends, and welcome back to another episode of Once Upon a Timeline, the Creative Editing Podcast. I am your host, Paddy Bird, and I want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy week to join me for this week's show. Every week, we take a creative or a career-based subject and dive deep into it. These are the things that I wish someone had told me throughout the various stages in my career. My job on this podcast is to turn you into a powerful creative editor. But before this week's discussion, let me get you up to date with all of the news from Inside the Edit. I'm really excited to say that you can now buy your front row seat to our upcoming bootcamp over at insidetheedit.com. So, what's it all about? Well, if you've ever wanted to learn how to use music in your edits, then come and join me on Saturday, the 4th of December, for our 2-hour live bootcamp webinar. This is one of the most powerful weapons any editor has in their skill set, and it is highly complex. There's so many things to think about. How we audition tracks, how we match scene tonality, how we assign character traits to musical elements, and dozens of other creative musical concepts are the things I'll be teaching in this special season of Inside the Edit Live Bootcamps. Part one of this series, we'll be looking at all of the fundamental things that you need to consider when approaching this part of the art form. And I'm going to arm you with tons of musical techniques that you can use straight away in your films. Go on over to insidetheedit.com right now and book your seat for just £49. Your clients will thank you for it. And finally, yes, it's that time of the year again. Black Friday weekend is just 7 days away. If you'd like to snap up a membership of Inside the Edit with a massive 50% off, then tune in to next week's show to get our half price discount code. This is the only sale that we do throughout the year, so make sure you don't miss out. Okay, it's time for this week's creative discussion. As regular listeners of this podcast will know, I'm a fan of studying and using certain aspects of psychology in my career. You know, I found its application in editing to be really useful and incredibly far-reaching. Now, I didn't study at school or anywhere else. I just started reading various books over the years. But like all human behavior, there's always a reason. And for me, there were two reasons I started on this fascinating research path in the first place. Now, the one that was most obvious was creative. As a self-taught filmmaker, I spent years reading books on everything from screenwriting to cinematography to production management to directing. I'd watch every single behind the scenes and making of documentary on the DVD extras that I had. I'd go on as many weekend courses of the famous filmmaking gurus when they came to London, all the while editing relentlessly all day and all night on whatever footage I could, trying to get better and better and build a sustainable freelance career. All of this intense learning and knowledge around scene structure and character study and camera movement, etc., etc., you know, it brought up an overarching feeling inside of me. A large part of what I was studying was human behavior within the confines of visual storytelling. How people behaved within a narrative structure seemed to be very high up on the list of things to study. And so it wasn't a massive leap for me to start spending more and more time in the psychology section of my favourite bookshops in central London. Studying the human animal and how it behaves made me a better editor. The body language, the tonality of a character's voice, the energy, the excitement levels throughout raw footage, the happiness, the sadness, and how all of this needed to be designed and structured into a narrative for the viewer. It occurred to me that, you know, the chaos of real life echoed the chaos of the raw footage. And so studying psychology and what human beings want, what they need and feel, would really refine my ability to select and deselect elements out of that chaotic and unstructured raw footage, especially in unscripted genres. But there were so many other positive knock-on effects that I really didn't anticipate. I started to ask myself what the psychological effect was when I created a sequence at one pace and then switched it to another. I studied how I felt when I altered the timing and delivery of a character's dialogue by adding space between their words at certain points and then tightening the space at others. I looked at the accumulative effect of certain types of camera movement and how they made me feel when cut to certain types of music. And all of this helped me put myself into the mind of the audience and focus on the feelings that I wanted to elicit in them. Behavior of the characters plus the psychological effect of the cutting pattern equals a highly thought out and effective sequence. In short, spending time researching and reading books on psychology, as well as all the other filmmaking books, helped me enormously with the creative aspects of our art form. It added value to me as an editing artist, especially in the eyes of my clients, and was therefore part of the fuel that helped me rise within the industry. But that was only half the reason psychology pulled me in. There was another side, and it was motivated by a feeling of helplessness. I'd spent the early part of my freelance career doing hundreds of little jobs in edit suites around London, short VTs, promos, corporate films, mood reels at ad agencies, pilot shows and daytime and low-budget TV, you know, hundreds of sequences, hundreds of clients, hundreds of edit suites. 2 days on one job, 3 days on another, go to this post house at 9 a.m. and ask for this person, get off at this station and walk around the corner to this production company. You're booked for a week on this, but if they like your work, then there's an option for a further 2 weeks. Don't screw it up. There's a good regular client to have here. Every single job mattered. Every single client was a source of income. If you have a cold or a flu and bail out at the last minute, or you turn up late or turn up hungover, you don't get paid. And most importantly, you won't work there again. The industry is small. Everyone knows everyone else, and people talk. This was how I slowly built a career in the post houses and production companies of London. I got my name out there and gradually rose through the ranks into where I really wanted to be, long form. But this was where things changed. Up until that point, I was relying on a very large amount of clients to give me small amounts of work with short durations. When I started to move into long form, that structure changed dramatically. Now I was being booked for weeks and often months at a time, and so I had far less clients throughout any 1 year. Of course, this was great from a creative and career trajectory perspective. I wanted to cut long form documentaries and entertainment shows and the like, but it also highlighted the fact that cultivating and protecting those contacts were much more important, as each one of them was worth a lot more money than a one-off small job. If I messed any of them up in some way, I wouldn't be losing just a couple of days' pay. I'd be potentially losing weeks or months of pay. And if that wasn't bad enough, I'd also be losing potential future work with that production company, post house, or broadcaster. And that could be disastrous. So, what was the structure here? I asked myself. What were the pressure points? What and where and who had influence over the success or failure of my career trajectory? Well, as always, there wasn't just one person, place, or thing. It was a combination of factors. But from a percentage point of view, I quickly worked out that a large percentage was the role of the directors. Directors, producers, or filmmaking clients in general wield an enormous amount of power over the success or failure of an editor's career. Now, there's positive and negative sides to this, of course. The positives are that if you get on well with the director, if they like your work and they like working with you, there's a very good chance that they will tell other directors about you. A brilliant editor, I've been told by so many of my director friends, is incredibly hard to find. They are rare creatures and very quickly make a name for themselves in the industry after a kind of certain point in their careers. It's strange, but directors kind of become like indirect agents for you, telling all their directing and production friends. You know, you start to appear on select lists that are created by broadcasters, post houses, and production companies if you're that good. You get calls from clients you don't know saying things like, "Oh, I was given your number by X after you worked on that, you know, blah, 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 blah film. I'm working on something new at the moment. I'd love to talk to you about it." You know, it's a really beautiful feeling when things like that happen and you get appreciated within the industry. But some editors also suffer a negative side as well. If the edit didn't go well, if you didn't get on with the director, if you don't impress them in any way or were combative or there was a personality clash, well, they have the power to not distribute your name at best and at worst actively transmit that you shouldn't be hired. Production managers, you know, often responsible for putting prospective editors' CVs in front of producers and directors for films, have long memories, and a bad review from a director, even years ago, can stain a reputation beyond repair. I've seen it happen. We must also remember that we are some of the most isolated people on any film. We come in at the end of the process. We're not in any of the production meetings or the shoot. We rarely meet all the other staff in the production company or the broadcaster or, you know, whoever we're working for. We never know what has been fed back about us into these companies and these senior position people, as we're never party to those type of conversations. They happen outside the edit suite. As I progressed through the years and heard the many horror stories and gossip within the filmmaking community, I realized that the director was a vital gateway and something I really needed to pay serious attention to. You know, I consistently reminded myself that a major goal in my career was to create as large a pool of people and companies who wanted to work with me as possible. That's future-proofing my career. There was no point being an amazing editor if no one wanted to work with me. I was therefore in a consistently vulnerable career position. And so I realized that I had to pay as much attention to cultivating the relationship with my directors as I did with crafting my timelines. I needed to limit negative feedback and heighten the percentage of positive feedback. And for me, this is where studying psychology came in. Now, before we go any further, I just want to make two broad points. Firstly, you may not be working with directors as part of your career as an editor. Not everyone does. You know, you may be a news editor and working for senior journalists, or a promo editor working with a corporate marketing company. It doesn't matter. We can substitute the title director with the title of client. What I'm broadly pointing at is anyone who is paying us to edit for them. Anyone who we're spending a lot of time with in a dark room. Anyone who we are competing for work with other editors. And secondly, I really do consider it a base level attitude within this industry to acknowledge the really positive role of the director, the stresses and responsibilities they are under, and the respect we as editors really need to give them. The vast percentage of directors I've had the privilege of working with over the course of my career have been approachable, positive, driven, courteous, and most of all, talented. It takes an enormous amount of energy, drive, and skill to thrive as a director. And the fact that these men and women and a lot of the other hardworking and talented people across the production process have been working so hard to produce this raw footage that just sits here on our timeline really should humble us every single time. It certainly does for me. That being said, human psychology being what it is, it would be foolish to ignore potential future fallouts and negative feelings that could and do often occur when two people are locked in a room together for long periods of time. Stressful situations happen in creative relationships, and we just need to know how to deal with them. So let's break down the factors at play and talk through some common scenarios. Firstly, let's reiterate what our clients want from us. Well, they want two things. One is obvious, one not so obvious. The obvious one we've already talked about. It's high-end creativity. They want us to be incredibly good at what we do on the timeline. That's pretty much a given. Many times, if you've made it into that editor's chair, there's just an assumption that you're pretty good at what you do. But secondly, and this one is less obvious and not always apparent to the director themselves, they want a certain type of behavior. And this is where it starts to get pretty interesting, because that behavior will be different from one director to the next. Let's open this up a bit. Now, when we say each director wants different behavior, we're not talking about the everyday and standard level of politeness, civility, and general overall professional courtesy. As a human being walking around on planet Earth, we all realize the need to have a base level of positive behavior when we interact with our fellow humans. What we're talking about here is something else. Every client we work with will be different. They'll have a different level of experience. They'll be at differing points in their career. They'll have a different creative style, etc., etc., etc. Now, this surface level stuff may seem obvious, but if we go deeper, it's good to realize that they'll also have different personality traits, a different sense of humor. They'll react to stress and pressure in different ways, and a whole host of internal psychological processes that influence how they behave. They may like to control the edit suite, or they may like to ask for help. One director may want a lengthy discussion before you cut anything to talk through all the options. The next one may want you to cut three different versions and then evaluate and have the discussion. We're literally rolling the dice with hundreds of possible working and behavioral traits at any one time. So the important point is, where does this leave us? Well, we want to analyze and utilize what we know about them and create a powerful working relationship as quickly as possible, while at the same time mitigating any personality clashes along the way. And so we'll need to be psychologically flexible and adaptable. And most importantly, we need to do this quickly. You know, each director is like a new country waiting to be discovered. That country will have its own ecosystem, political structure, economy, foreign policy, history, culture, and perception of itself. A wise editor is someone who analyzes this and works out the best way to work with them as quickly as possible. Just like trying to find the meaning of a scene as quickly as possible, you know, to save time and focus in on the story, finding the value system or behavioral traits of our clients is a really useful exercise. The more of these personal and creative nuances we discover early on, the smoother the relationship is going to be. Trust is created sooner, and therefore the flow of ideas between you both ramps up. You know, when creative people talk about how well they work with a certain person, it's usually to do with each other's ability to hone in on these nuances and work with them and not against them. There really is nothing more beautiful, you know, from a work perspective, then when we're completely synced creatively with our clients, it's got a light feeling, it's productive, it's inspirational, you bounce off each other and you both feel safe in trying things out without the fear of being judged. You know, doing some basic personality assessment at the very beginning of the job and the relationship, which we all kind of instinctively do to a certain degree anyway, it really is, you know, it's vital. What are the individual ingredients, the psychological recipe, if you will, that make up this director, this producer, this client? You know, this was really brought home to me when I was working on some of the bigger reality TV shows back in the day. In certain types of reality shows, you are on a kind of conveyor belt of content. It's a real sausage factory. You know, you may have 5, 10, 15 editors working in shifts around the clock and all cutting shorter sequences that feed into a big main show. But the interesting thing for me was seeing and being exposed to, and more importantly, working with a very high volume of different directors and producers in such a short space of time. I would work with several in one day, and I found it really interesting seeing all of the differences in their working practice, what they looked for, their response times, what they wanted, how they reacted to stress, their sense of humor, how you would ingratiate yourself with them, whether they were lighthearted in their approach or serious. And this experience really taught me about the power of adaptability. It was the whole editing experience at 200 frames per second, high speed, creative and psychological flexibility in action. And there's a name for this in the psychological literature, the chameleon effect. The chameleon, a small but distinctive lizard that lives in various warm climates across the globe, is of course famous for its amazing ability to change color. Now, many people think that this ability for self-camouflage is solely as a kind of anti-predator defense mechanism, but that is just one of its uses. The chameleon changes color for a range of reasons. Social signaling, reactions to temperature, and other conditions dependent on their environment. They regulate their body temperature through color changes. They show brighter colors when displaying aggression to other chameleons and darker colors when they submit and give up. In short, they adapt to the environment for numerous social and physical reasons, and they do it incredibly quickly. They change themselves to get the most out of their surroundings. What is not to love about these beautiful little creatures? We can learn a lot from them. Now, it's long been known in psychology that this chameleon effect, the fact that if human beings are in close proximity to someone else for long periods of time, they often take on traits, mannerisms and opinions, etc., 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 you know, from that person. Think of people in long-term relationships or, you know, even siblings. But for us as editors, there's no reason we can't take this and hack the psychology behind it. Adapt ourselves for two reasons. Number one, not to cause a personality clash. And number two, to ingratiate ourselves. Now, I want to state here before we go any further on this point that I'm not talking about completely changing our personalities, you know, every single time we work with someone new and turning ourselves into some kind of needy and easily changeable, desperate person. Absolutely not. I'm talking about analyzing the other person and applying emotional intelligence to best facilitate a harmonious working relationship. Let me give you an example. Let's say we start working with a director who's, you know, is a little bit insecure, and therefore one of their defenses to that is they like to be in control. You know, it's a light character defect. We've all got them, so it's important not to judge. And we can spot this under the surface. No big deal. Now, for whatever reason they are like this, if we start to try and subtly assert control ourselves, or maybe even act very confident in front of them, on a subconscious level, there's a very high probability that this will create a small personality conflict. And then a negative seed is sown. Ask any pro editor, and they'll tell you that they've been in a situation where an inexperienced or slightly insecure director has told them to do something to the film just to show who's in charge and not because it's the best idea for the film. That is ego at work, And if we were to fight fire with fire and tell them it's not a good idea right then and there, we are basically saying that they are not in control, which is not a good idea. It really is unnecessary conflict. Now, these types of things don't happen very often, but they do and will happen throughout our careers at some point. And so spotting and realizing what's going on underneath the surface, the subtext, you know, as quickly as possible is very important. Sometimes it's better to lose the battle to win the war. Just like the subtle layers when crafting the psychological journey in our scenes and sequences, the same is applicable for the subtle nuances in the relationship with our clients. And let me hammer this point home as well. This is not about manipulation. It is not some Machiavellian trick to influence and trick our clients. It's about methodically studying how they behave and fine-tuning and eliminating any potential conflict between you both so that we can optimize the creative relationship as quickly as possible. You know, the balance of power in an edit suite can and does shift, but it is underpinned by one very big fact. Yes, we work with directors, but we also work for them. We're here to facilitate their vision. They may be stressed at times. They may be short-tempered at times. They may even be curt at times. But 99% of the time, it's not personal. And it's up to us to not take it personally and adapt to what they need at that point. Throwing ego back at them and searching for justice is a fool's errand. I've seen quite a few editors over the years let their ego play a very damaging role in the creative relationship, which has limited their careers and potential for success. Nothing will guarantee a limited career in this art form more than an unchecked ego. You can only ride that horse for so long before you get kicked off. After 25 years in the industry, I think that a big component to crafting a successful career is our ability to curtail our ego, be charming, take negative feedback well, and not react in the moment to stressful situations. It is how we make directors feel that often sticks in their memory the most. Long after the job is finished and they're looking back at editors they've worked with in the past for their new upcoming film, it's that emotional resonance that they'll connect with when weighing up if they want to work with us again or not. That, and obviously whether we're a brilliant editor as well, but, you know, that's a different subject. Directors want a stress-free edit, and if we create a nurturing environment that bends and shapes to their emotional state in an intelligent, empathetic, and compassionate way, then we are maximizing the chances that they'll want to work with us again. You know, high on the list of big human needs is the need to be appreciated and respected. Just like when we're looking and studying all the body language and behavioral traits of our characters in the films we cut, we're cutting and designing and paying an enormous amount of attention to the slightest detail in their facial tics or voice tonality and passing that on into a beautiful structure for our audience. And so we also need to be astute and emotionally intelligent enough to know that we need to pay just as much care and attention to our own behavior when communicating with our directors. They will pick this up too. We need to repeatedly keep our eye on the goal to get as many clients as possible to work with us. Some of my greatest friendships, you know, have grown out of these working relationships, and I've made lifelong friends. But stepping into each one of them should be acknowledging the influence that they could have on our careers. We don't want them to come away feeling bad about having worked with us. We want them to feel like it was a fantastic creative experience. And so I like to think of them as potential lifetime subscribers to our work as artists. If in doubt, we can just remind ourselves of that beautiful little lizard. I hope you enjoyed this week's creative discussion, dear friends, and I hope you can put many of these things into good use in your career. If you have any creative questions for me or there's a particular subject that you'd like to hear talked about on the show, email me at podcast@insidetheedit.com. I love hearing from our Inside the Edit community. Do you want to take your editing to an elite level? Then our creative editing course was built specifically for you. We've helped thousands of editors, directors, producers, news journalists, social media experts, and marketing pros to become high-end visual storytellers. Our step-by-step course is made up of over 100 tutorials that take you through every single aspect of the art of editing. Learn at your own pace and practice on the 35 hours of free raw footage you receive as a member. You can sign up to our free 2-week trial over at insidetheedit.com. We turn you into a powerful creative editor. And don't forget, dear friends, if you want to learn one of the most important parts of creative editing, how to cut music, then join me on Saturday, the 4th of December, for our 2-hour live bootcamp webinar. This is the first part of a series of live sessions that we're doing over the coming months to really demystify and break down this powerful part of our art form. In this first session, we're going to look at all of the essential thought processes, the techniques, and the creative concepts around music use. These are the high-end musical skills that you need to be at the very top of the editing ladder. The 2-hour session is live, so you'll be able to ask me as many questions as you'd like, and it only costs £49. Of course, if you're already an Inside the Edit member, you get your massive members discount. Go on over to insidetheedit.com right now to book your seat. This one is going to be amazing. Okay, that is a wrap. Episode 2 of the 3rd season of Once Upon a Timeline, the creative editing podcast, is in the can. A massive shout out to our longtime friends over at Universal Production Music who supply every single track for our show. And if you like any of these tracks and you think they'd be perfect for something you're cutting right now, as usual, go on over to the podcast page over at insidetheedit.com and you'll find all the links and track names so you can license them for your current project. Please don't forget to tag us on social, and if our show has helped you out creatively, we'd really appreciate it if you share it with your filmmaking friends. However, if you do have a spare 30 seconds, a rate and review on Apple Podcasts is really, 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 really appreciated. Thank you so much for being part of the Inside the Edit community. Have a great weekend, dear friends, and I will see you very soon on another episode of Once Upon a Timeline. Stay cool, stay safe, and stay cutting.